It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the tourism and hospitality industry has been hit hard by COVID-19. We zero in on what the data from Door County shows us about the season. First, you can make it if you try. That's been the assumption in American politics and society for a long time now, with leaders from both parties saying that with enough effort and education, anyone can be successful. But our next guest says that the merit-based view of advancement can leave a lot of people out, and it's used to justify the success of those already at the top. He also says it's led to political resentment from millions of Americans and that the country needs to rethink its attitude towards success to give more people economic power and a democratic voice. Michael Sandel teaches political philosophy at Harvard University. His latest book is The Tyranny of Merit: What's Become of the Common Good? Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Rob.
Well, your book, Michael, and our conversation center around the concept of meritocracy. So can you start us off with a good working definition?
Well, there are really two. The idea of merit by itself is a good thing. People should be eligible for jobs and social roles not based on prejudice or where they come from or what their background is. That's a good thing. But there's another side of merit that says those who succeed, those who land on top, provided chances are equal, deserve their success and deserve all of the material rewards that come with it. And that's the version of meritocracy that we've been living out in recent decades, and that actually has turned out to be corrosive of the common good. It's contributed, I think, to the polarization that afflicts our politics today.
A lot of times, I think, when people talk about meritocracy, and you cite a lot of politicians from different parties through the course of your book, thinking that the concept of meritocracy is good, but maybe it's held up. The wealthy person can pass benefits on to their kid. That interferes with the smooth flowing of meritocracy. Racial discrimination might, if we just get those obstacles out of the way, meritocracy will make for a common good. You don't buy that. You think even a perfectly functioning meritocracy will come out with bad results. Why?
Right. Because those that, and we've seen this in recent decades, Rob, the divide between winners and losers has been deepening, poisoning our politics and driving us apart. And the reason is not just the inequality of income and wealth that we've seen, but also the changing attitudes towards success. Those who've landed on top have come to believe that their success is their own doing, and that by implication, those who struggle, those left out, have no one to blame but themselves. So it generates, I call it meritocratic hubris among the winners, a tendency to forget the luck and good fortune that helped them on their way. And it also produces demoralization, even humiliation among those who left out, who are told they have no one but themselves to blame if they haven't done what it takes to clamber up the ladder of success. That's the dark side of meritocracy, and I think it's playing out in our politics today and fueling the resentment of a great many working people who feel elites have been looking down on them. And this resentment has fueled the populist backlash that we saw in 2016, including the grievances that Trump appeals to.
You say that many people feel the perception that elites have toward them, that a sense of condescension. And as you write, they're not necessarily wrong to feel that way. You cite some examples of, again, leaders from the economic world, the political world in both parties that can be pretty condescending based on that meritocratic ideal. What have we seen?
Yeah, and part of it has to do with the advice that mainstream politicians, Democrats and Republicans alike, have offered working people and middle-class people as the global economy has brought this deepening inequality. The way they've dealt with this inequality has not been to take it on directly, trying to reconfigure the economy to alleviate the inequality. They've taken it on indirectly. They've said, if you want to compete and win in this new global economy, go to college, What you earn will depend on what you learn, the ability to get a diploma. And then you can rise. You can rise as far as your efforts and talents will take you, but you have to get a university diploma. The problem with this is it's great to emphasize college education, to broaden access to college. That's a good thing. But most people in our society, and we forget this, don't have a four-year college degree. Nearly two-thirds of Americans don't. And so to build an economy based on the assumption that dignified work and a decent life depends on a university degree, that's a recipe for disappointment, for exclusion, and for mounting resentment. And I think that's what we've seen.
We're talking to Michael Sandel about his new book, The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of meritocracy and how it works or doesn't work in the United States? Do you feel that our economy is built to reward people with that college degree, that four-year degree, and in some ways to punish those without? Do you think there's a bias in our society against people without that degree? 800-642-1234 is the number. And I want to pursue that point now, Michael. You spent a chapter on this concept that there's an economic bias against people without that college degree, but also kind of a social and prestige bias, a civic bias against them. Talk about how that plays out.
Right. It's a kind of credentialism. And I suggest that in the book, I say that credentialism is, in a way, the last acceptable prejudice. Now, there are still plenty of prejudices throughout our society that give rise to injustice, prejudices based on race and class and gender and ethnicity. But what we don't really face up to is the tendency of well-credentialed, well-educated elites to look down on those who have lesser educational credentials than themselves. And this, I think, rankles, rightly, those who don't have a college degree, but who nonetheless do important jobs, make important contributions to the common good. And Trump has picked up on this. You remember after one of his primary victories in 2016, he said, "I love the poorly educated," because he knew they were voting for him. And the educational divide has become one of the best predictors of partisan allegiance in this country. Trump is alive to this. It's not just a matter of jobs and wage stagnation. It's not just economic inequality that is the source of the anger and resentment. It's also a sense that those who haven't been to university and therefore don't occupy jobs in the professional elite, that somehow the work they do, the lives they live, are less worthy, less admirable. We valorize those who in the professional classes with lustrous credentials. And this denigration, this disparagement of the dignity of work and of working people, I think has been the unacknowledged source of weakness for the Democratic Party, and Trump has exploited it. He's very good at exploiting these grievances.
How do we start to not recreate, but I guess acknowledge the dignity of being an American without that degree? We've done it more in the past, I think. We had, you know, the Abraham Lincolns who did pretty okay, I think. How do we go back to that?
Right. Well, I think one thing we have to do is question the idea, and this has only come in recent decades, that universities are the arbiters of opportunity. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't broaden access to university. I've spent my career in higher education. But do we really want universities to allocate opportunity? They become sorting machines, the universities have, dispensing the credentials and defining the merit that the society rewards and honors even valorizes. And partly as a result, we have woefully underinvested in forms of learning that most people need and depend on to prepare for the world of work and for citizenship. For example, state colleges, two-year community colleges, forms of vocational and technical training. We underinvest in them, and we don't really accord them the respect that they are due, which gets back to the point you were emphasizing, Rob, about this not only being about economics, it's also about recognition and honor and esteem. This is a point that I try to emphasize in the book, because this is what provokes really the sense of resentment and humiliation among people who feel that not only the economy, but also the culture have left them behind, which is why we need, I think, a renewed emphasis on the dignity of work.
We're talking to Michael Sandel, professor of political philosophy at Harvard, author of the new book, The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good? You can join in at 800-642-1234. You feel like we need to rethink our attitudes about what it means to be successful and what it takes to get there? Do you feel looked down upon by politicians or others, maybe because of the work you do or your educational level? Do those feelings translate into how you vote during elections? What do you think we need to do to bring us together and give us the sense that we're all in this together? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation and hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Michael Sandel, political philosopher and author of the new book, The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do we need to rethink the way we define success in the United States and the tools for success? Do you feel like your profession, your educational level is looked down on? What would it take to get the dignity, the respect that people deserve, even if they don't have the four-year degree that's often seen as the ticket to success? Join in at 800-642-1234. We've got full phone lines. Let's go to your calls now. Rick is with us in Oshkosh. Rick, hello.
Hey, hello. Thank you. So I had a question from Bill. I wanted to try to really understand, because I think it makes sense from his conclusions as to whether the problem is a meritocracy or the problem is the humility of those that actually win. You know, I'm struck by what I feel is the mistake in making all kids a winner when there's a sporting event. Everybody gets a trophy, and we've tried to teach humility by essentially saying everybody's a winner instead of the harder work of saying there are people that will win in certain ways and other people will win in other ways, and we want to respect all of that. But I'm worried about throwing the baby out with the bathwater and saying the problem is meritocracy and we need to kind of level the playing field. So I'd love to get his thoughts on that, because I think one could really draw some exaggerated conclusions.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Michael, you talk about that humility issue. What do you think of what Rick had to bring up there?
Rick raises a really interesting question. And I would say this. I don't think... Well, let me start with the idea of humility. In the book, I write about humility as the civic virtue we need now, and I think it's in short supply. And the reason it's in short supply has to do with the attitudes towards success that many of the winners have come to adopt. And right at the center of those attitudes is the idea that my success is my own doing. This forgets the luck and good fortune that helped me on my way. A greater appreciation, Rick, of the role of luck in life can prompt a certain humility among the winners. And here I'm not talking about pretending that everyone is a winner by giving all of the kids an award regardless of how well they perform. That's not what I'm suggesting. But what I am suggesting is that we think hard about what counts as contributing to the common good. We often assume that the money people make is the measure of their contribution to the common good, but that's a mistake. So I'm saying we need to encourage greater humility among the winners, because if they recognize the elements of luck and good fortune in success, maybe they'll inhale a little bit less deeply of that success and be more open to a generous response toward those of their fellow citizens who may struggle, not because they're to blame, but because of the shape of the economy and the alternatives that have been put before them. That's what I have in mind. Another way of putting it is there are many ways of winning, and we have a tendency to collapse them all into the measure of money. And that's one of the things we need to rethink if we're to aim for a politics of the common good.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Dan with us now in De Pere. Dan, hi.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. Your guest, I think, is spot on. I remember 50 years ago, the heart of the Democratic Party was the blue-collar laborer. And now the impression is that they turn their nose up to these folks, and they've become the party of this liberal college elite combined with people that are dependent upon government charity and government handouts in order to get by. And you walk around see all the road signs of all these of union members, union members and former union members, because they broke the unions. There's Trump signs everywhere because they feel they've been left out of the Democratic Party. So I think he's spot on.
Dan, thanks for the call. I'll throw in one more group you point toward, Michael, successful people on Wall Street getting a lot of deference, you write, from presidents from the Democratic Party, for example.
Yes, it's interesting. And Dan, I think is on to an important point, that blue-collar workers traditionally were right at the heart of the constituency of the Democratic Party. And increasingly, the Democratic Party has become the party of professional, well-educated elites, including large parts of the people who work in the financial industry. In 2008, Barack Obama raised more money from Wall Street than his Republican opponent. This was the first time that was true of a Democratic candidate for president. It reflects a shift that was underway during the decades of globalization, when the Democratic Party became more attuned to the professional classes, and this alienated, and the policies they enacted, deregulating finance, for example, during the last years of the Clinton administration, this contributed to alienating and the working class, blue-collar workers. And so Trump, who played to the anger and resentments that we've been discussing, was able to win a disproportionate share of white working class voters who lacked a college degree. And so I think the Democratic Party needs to reconnect with the dignity of work, with support for unions, and this means challenging its too easy association with the credentialed professional classes. It's been a very consequential shift. Dan is right about that. Interestingly, the same thing has happened to the Labour Party in Britain, to the Social Democratic parties in Europe. And it has to do, I think, with the way center-left parties, they bought into the market-driven version of globalization that has played out in the last several decades.
Thanks for that call, Dan. We're talking to Michael Sandel about his new book, The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. Let's go now to John on the line in Milwaukee. John, hello.
Hello. Listen, I think the last comment or call-in was on target, and yet I think we're building a false paradigm here, that to say the Democratic Party has somehow lost sight of the working class. I mean, let's look at what actually has happened, is that the Republican Party, Republican governors, Republican playbook, has been to close, shut down, demoralize the unions, close them. It's a cost savings. Those unions, trade unions, were the heart and soul of this country and still should be. And they've been so denigrated and underfunded and cut in school programs, colleges, two-year colleges. The unions provided that training. They provided that kind of recognition of professional training and professional investment that is the heart and soul of our everyday life, our plumbing, our electricity, our homes.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Michael, Republicans and unions and how they fit into all this.
I think John is spot on. I agree with John completely that the Republicans have been hostile to unions and that unions are the heart and soul of this country, really, and of not only of the support for the economic prospects of working people, but also giving working people a meaningful voice in politics. So I don't want to be misunderstood. And if you read the book, this is clear. I am not in any way defending the Republican response to unions or their tax policies. I don't think that they represent the interests of working people in their policies. I don't think they have a persuasive program for the dignity of work. But that leaves a big question, Rob. And the question is this. If Trump's policies, if his economic policies, if very few of them help working people with regard to health care, with regard to tax policies that give tax breaks disproportionately to millionaires and billionaires, why is it that even so, many working people support Trump and voted for him in 2016? That's the question. And my answer, the book really is an attempt to answer that question. And the answer I give has to do with the Democratic Party's embrace of market-based globalization, their role in deregulating the financial industry, their role in going along with Republicans.
And I'm going to jump in. We're going to pick up the conversation. We've got to listen to some news now. Michael Sandel is with us. His new book is The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. Still time for you to join with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. More coming up with Michael Sandel. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our talk with Michael Sandel. He teaches political philosophy at Harvard University. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with Don on the line in La Crosse. Don, hi.
Hi. I want to know about people that don't have a high school degree or diploma. I'll take my answer offline.
Don, thanks for the call. Michael, we talked about the college-non-college divide. How about people without that high school diploma?
They struggle even more in this economy, which is all the more reason why we have to invest in forms of learning and job training that can enable them to learn what they need to be able to flourish in the world of work. There's no reason we can't do this. But it's a matter of political will, and it's also a matter of broadening our concept of what it is to respect the different contributions that people make in this economy. I could just add one more thought, Rob. During this pandemic, we suddenly realize, we can't help but notice, how deeply dependent we are on the contribution of workers we often overlook. I'm not just speaking about those in the hospitals who are caring for COVID patients, but delivery workers, warehouse workers, truck drivers, home health care workers, workers in the gig economy who enable a lot of us to be able to work remotely. Now we're calling them essential workers, but these are not the best paid. Often they are not the most highly educated. And they are certainly not the most honored workers in our society. But I think our recognition now, during this crisis, of the importance of their contribution, we're calling them essential, after all, that could prompt a rethinking of the dignity of work and the way we reward, also the way we honor the various contributions that people make to our economy and to the common good, however credentialed or otherwise they may be.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Ben now in Northern Illinois. Ben, hi.
Hello and good afternoon. I wanted to talk about this from a slightly different perspective in looking at something that's kind of rampant in many levels of education, which is the sort of denigration and outright ignoring of learners who are referred to as kinesthetic learners. In other words, these are people who learn by virtue of physically actually doing something, as opposed to working with models and abstractions and perhaps acquiring information through strictly visual or auditory or some combination thereof. If you look carefully at, for example, in engineering, half the time you're worried about learning mathematics and science and other things, but as for actually doing something, as in building or constructing or something like that, this is not exactly on the plan, even though, in fact, you'll be doing a lot of that in the actual work itself, for an example. And there are also many other kinds of places where work that depends upon a kinesthetic learning base is actually devalued in the academic world, as a matter of fact.
Ben, I want to jump in because we've got a lot of other callers waiting, but I think we take your point. Michael, we look down maybe on the things you can learn by doing as opposed to learning by being in a classroom.
Yeah, Ben makes a good point, and I need to learn more about that, but it certainly is a point that fits with the general concern I have about too narrow an understanding about what it means to equip people for success.
Thanks for that call. Alan joins us next in Eau Claire. Alan, hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'll try to be brief. There's way too much emphasis put on college nowadays because, and you got to think about it. My dad told me years ago, he says, I don't care what you do with your life. He says, but no matter what, the world is always going to need ditch diggers. Ditch diggers being trades, plumbers, construction, working outside. Now, on top of that, ditch digging pays really good. And it gives you a great sense of being and wealth and self, improvement. And it's also an essential job. My job was never threatened throughout this whole pandemic.
Alan, thanks a lot. The trades, in effect, Michael.
Yeah, Alan makes a great point. And we've got to find a way as a society to broaden our notion of respect, to encompass dignity and respect and appreciation for all of the jobs on which we depend, and whether engaging in trades or digging ditches, as Alan reminds us, these two are important contributions to the common good. And I have some suggestions in the book about policies that would prompt a public debate about this. For example, should we really tax earnings from labor, from real work, more than we tax earnings from interests and dividends? Should we consider wage subsidies for jobs that are important but that the market undervalues? What about reducing the payroll tax, which is a tax on ordinary labor, and making up the difference by a tax on financial transactions? These are some of the proposals I make in the book, not as a solution to these problems, but a way at least of beginning a debate about how we broaden our appreciation of the full range of jobs that contribute to the common good.
To follow up on that point, though, there are some jobs in some communities where I think people felt the same way. People are always going to need coal, so there's always going to be a job in the mine. People are always going to need paper, so there's always going to be a job in the local paper mill. And it might have been true for a couple generations. How do we cope, though, when either we shift from coal or we shift those plants to another state or another country? How do we account for those workers who, through really no fault of their own, have had that expectation upended?
Right. Well, that is a very serious question. And we, as we move from a carbon-based economy toward a green, more sustainable economy, we had better do it in a way that puts workers first, and that and at the very start of these policy transitions, asks how can we take advantage of the the skills and the work experience of people working, say, in as coal miners, to provide them with the skills they need to contribute to the transition to a less carbon reliant economy. We can do that, provided we start with respect for those workers who have spent their lives in a coal mine, let's say, not think about them after we've already developed a nice blueprint for a green economy. We have to start with those who are doing the work and how to help them in a transition in a way that not only preserves their livelihood, but also accords them the respect they deserve.
We are talking to Michael Sandel about his new book, The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. Let's bring on another caller. Christopher is with us in Appleton. Christopher, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, I see that folks, you know, historically have always voted against their economic interest, and I think it's getting deeper than that now. I think we have, after, you know, Newt Gingrich and the moral majority came in, the right has started to just side with the right, and they're going to vote not only against their economics, but a lot of other factors. And to juxtapose that, I guess we'll say the social justice warriors on the left. And a lot of folks that are in the middle, I don't mean political, I just mean maybe aren't as concerned with the moral majority or aren't as concerned with social justice, kind of end up being left out of the conversation. And that's a huge, I think, a vast majority of people. And I think that is a product of the two-party system and folks just not feeling like they have anybody that truly represents them. And that's, you know, I think a problem of classism.
Right.
Interesting. Christopher, the two-party system, I don't think you'd argue, Michael, doesn't represent everybody.
Right. I agree with Christopher. I think that the two parties, both parties, have failed to speak to the things that matter most to a great many people. And I think that's why there's so much disaffection from the political system. I think that's why representative democracy is in trouble, why people are frustrated with the empty terms of public discourse. And so what I mean by a new politics of the common good is reshaping the terms of public discourse. Most of what passes for political discourse these days consists of shouting matches on talk radio or cable television where people don't really listen to one another. And part of one way we have to, I think, address this is to create more class mixing common places in public spaces in our everyday lives. We've increasingly separated our even ways of living on the basis of class, and that's not good for anybody because it deprives us of the chance to encounter one another and to realize that we're engaged in a common project as democratic citizens. There's a lot of work to be done in rebuilding class mixing institutions in everyday life.
In our last couple minutes, what could that look like? What is your vision for how we bring people together in common situations and hopefully make them realize that there is such a thing as a common good?
Well, part of the problem is that as inequality has deepened in recent decades, as we have relied more and more on markets to define the value of our contribution to the common good, those who are affluent and those of modest means increasingly lead separate lives. We live and work and shop and play in different places. We send our kids to different schools. But and democracy does not require perfect equality, but it does require that people come together from different walks of life in the course of everyday life, encountering one another, bumping up against one another, whether in sports stadiums or public transportation or health clinics or municipal centers or public parks or libraries, cultural institutions. This is what we need to rebuild, because unless this is how we learn, this is how we learn to negotiate and to abide our differences, and this is how we come to care for the common good. So we need to lean against allowing markets to define us and inequality to separate us, to recover the dignity of work, and also to open the space, the actual concrete practices of everyday life that will remind us that we are all in this together and that for all our differences, We need a politics that reaches for the common good.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I really enjoyed it.
Michael Sandel teaches political philosophy at Harvard University. He was with us to talk about his new book, The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. Coming up, a Wisconsin reporter joins us with a look at what the data shows us about Door County tourism during the pandemic and what it could mean for the future. That's up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The coronavirus brought travel and tourism to a screeching halt this spring. But as we learned more, lockdowns were lifted, precautions were taken, many people started to move around again. Our next guest has been gathering the data to get a better understanding of travel and tourism and how it was affected in one of Wisconsin's most popular areas, Door County. Sammy Gibbons is a reporter for the Door County Advocate. Sammy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, it's no secret, tourism, a big part of the Door County economy. Can you talk about what happened right off the bat in early spring when this pandemic first hit?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you can see it pretty clearly in the data. There was a massive drop off in April, which, as we know, was kind of when a lot of numbers started spiking. That's when Door County at least spiked, and that's when they reported their first COVID-related death. So numbers absolutely plummeted in April. And then they did sort of start to creep up as the summer went on. We still don't have July and August data since, you know, lodging data is a couple months behind. It was clear that less people were coming. And then as the state started opening up, we saw the numbers climb along with it.
And the sense I get from reading your piece is that from the vantage point of April, March and April, it looked like this was disastrous for Door County. With a couple more months under the belt and talking to people since then, still bad, but not as bad as maybe people were expecting in the spring.
Yeah. I just went up there actually a couple of weeks ago in August, and people had said that they had been booming since about May. Obviously, June, July, August are kind of the peak tourist seasons. June especially is when they see an influx usually. So people were doing the camping trips and going to the beaches now that it was super nice out and there wasn't much else to do. So yeah, many business owners that I spoke to did say that they had actually, some had seen, you know, a spike in revenue and had been busier than ever. So, a lot of people expected the worst, and it still might be, they still kind of do expect to fall shorter than they have in previous summers. And many of them say they won't really completely feel those effects until possibly next summer when they have to kind of reopen again and then have to deal with their finances, and that's when they'll sort of see the losses they took in this unusual season.
For a lot of these businesses, it wasn't just the hit to the revenue. There were some costs that went up. What did you find when you talked to people at different kinds of tourism-related businesses?
Yeah, so a lot of people talked to me about how they spent a lot more money on personal protective gear and things to keep customers safe. I talked to one business owner of a candy store up way north in Ellison Bay who talked about having to move her whole store outside so that people could come and shop safely. So that was a big expense. People started supplying masks or had a bunch of hand sanitizer pumps all over their store, which comes at a cost. So those things to stay open ended up costing them things that they didn't have budgeted because no one expected to be in a pandemic a year ago. So there were definitely some extra costs that are going to appear later on when they have to reevaluate how this summer performed financially.
Talking to Sammy Gibbons, reporter for the Door County Advocate, looking at one of Wisconsin's biggest tourist markets, Door County, how it was affected from the data we have so far by the coronavirus pandemic. Now, you talked to people about their foot traffic in stores and things like that. You also looked at data for literal traffic, how many people were driving to Door County. What does state data tell us?
Yeah, it does show us that there was a fall from previous summers. I specifically looked mostly at 2019, of course, the most recent summer. The major highway that connects the rest of Wisconsin to what I like to call Wisconsin's thumb, Door and Kewaunee counties, had a 36% less vehicles In April of this year compared to the same month in 2019. So like I said, April was when the first death was reported and kind of when schools started closing and everything went haywire. So it does make sense that there was a big cut to traffic there. But a lot of other, I looked at five total major points where the Wisconsin Department of Transportation monitors cars that go by, and all of them did see on average a 3% drop in traffic across three of them are bridges in Sturgeon Bay and then a couple of highway points. So one did see a bit of a spike, one of the historical Michigan Street Bridge in Sturgeon Bay. A lot of people like to drive across that bridge anyway. So overall, yes, fewer cars seen this summer, unsurprisingly.
You also asked some business owners if they were seeing, when it came to the tourists who did come, the usual suspects or different customers coming. What did you hear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one hotel owner said that they saw a drastic change in clientele. They said usually it's their returning customers didn't come back this summer. And that's because a lot of their returning customers are 50s, 60s or higher. So a lot of them are in that at-risk category of getting severe effects if they were to come down with COVID-19. So he told me that they did see more 20s, 30s and people under 50 coming this year. And a lot of people said that they did see a lot more, they noticed a lot more locals coming. And a lot of them talked about how there were pushes throughout the county to support your local businesses. And since Door County is a fairly small county, there's about 27,000 people total. A lot of these communities are tight-knit. So pretty much every business owner I talked to talked about how it did seem like more locals were coming and checking out stores they hadn't really been to. You know, less neighbors than tourists because people wanted to help one another out, which is kind of how Door County is.
You talked to a bookstore owner, among other things, about wearing masks. What did you hear about customers' willingness to put on that mask?
Yeah, so I did ask a lot of business owners about that. And luckily, most of them said they didn't have any issues. But the bookstore owner, Otherworlds Books and More in Sturgeon Bay, they did talk about experiencing some pushback from customers who just didn't agree with the mask mandate and didn't want to wear it, even though they were being asked to. The owners had set up a system so that there were only a certain number of people in the store. So sometimes big groups would come and they would ask half the group to stay outside. And then the whole group would get mad that they couldn't shop together. Also not included in the article, I had spoken to a restaurant owner who said that people were coming in and yelling at the hostess, who was a young teenager who was just getting yelled at by these people just for asking them to wear a mask. So like I said, luckily it seems like generally people were respectful of that request, but definitely as we've seen in the news across the nation, there was some pushback for those requests.
Sammy, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Sammy Gibbons, reporter for the Door County Advocate. She joined us for a look at tourism in Door County during the year of the pandemic based on the data available so far and her interviews, as we heard, from business owners in the area. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, COVID cases are going up in many Wisconsin counties, but it's not always easy to make sense of all the numbers. We'll get the latest from WisContext and learn more about the story told by the data. It's this week's edition of Food Friday with some great recipes for this weekend's Rosh Hashanah celebration that we can use any time of year. And there are lots of fun things for families to do this fall, even during the pandemic. A guest shares 50 fun activities, or as many as we can actually get to. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. If you're one of those people who really goes all out for Halloween decorating and you're looking for that one decoration to put you over the top to make sure you outshine all competitors in your neighborhood, here it is. A full-size Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton. Not a replica, the real thing. Yours for the bargain basement price of somewhere from $6 to $8 million. As reported by CNN, a nearly complete T-Rex skeleton is going on display at the auction house Christie's. The auction is scheduled for October 6th. Oh, his name is Stan, by the way, the T-Rex, after the amateur paleontologist who found the first bones in 1987. Stan was found in South Dakota and has been heavily studied there over the years. If you're trying to figure out how to work Stan into your Halloween display, here are the specs. Stan is about 13 feet tall, 40 feet long, and made up of 188 bones, as long as teeth are over 11 inches long. In life, about 67 million years ago, Stan would have weighed in at 7 to 8 tons, like two elephants worth of Stan. Some minor wear is present, possibly from a fight with another T-Rex. If you're planning to make a bid next month and you live in some kind of condo arrangement, maybe check out your homeowner's agreement first. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.